This is Eleanor Swent, continuing the interview with Bud Wilson in Los Altos on July 9th, 1996.
What are we going to talk about?
Well, let's talk about Stibnite. Wait a minute. What about that in here? You didn't say anything yet about where did you live? What sort of living accommodations did you have there?
Well, when we first summer we were there, Deb and I lived in the school teacher's house in Yellow Pine.
They provided teachers,
did they? Well, we had a misunderstanding with the man who hired me, who was supposed to provide us a house, but he did not. And we stayed at a little hotel in Yellow Pine. And the owner of the hotel was the head of the school district. So he took pity on us and let us move into the schoolhouse. And I guess we lived there. I don't mean schoolhouse, I mean the teacher's house. And we lived there July, August, and I think we finally moved up the mine September.
And this, where was this, in the town of?
Yeah, right in the town of Yellow Pine.
Yellow Pine. Uh-huh. And the mine was up the road a ways.
The mine was 14 miles up the canyon from Yellow Pine.
And Stibnite was, I'm trying to get this straight in my mind. Stibnite was.
You see?
Down the.
Yeah, you see the town of Yellow Pine.
Right. And it's on a river.
Yeah. East Fork and the South Fork of the Salmon River.
The Salmon, okay. The East Fork of the South Fork of the Salmon River.
Yeah.
Okay. So the river's going west?
Yeah.
North. Uh-huh. Yeah. So Stibnite is up?
Yeah, up the canyon.
Up the canyon. Mm-hmm. And the mine is in this area between the two.
Well, no, I think actually the mine is probably just right about where the dock indicating the location of Stibnite. It's hard to tell from this map, but the mine, the open pit was just about 2 miles. A mile and a half from the main town, mm-hmm. Yellow Pine.
So when you moved up to the mine, what sort of accommodations did you have?
Again, we lived in a teacher's house, and this was a house that had been constructed from two boxcars.
Oh.
Yeah. And two bedrooms, one bath, small living room, kitchen, the wood stove.
Wood stove?
Yep.
Were the boxcars side by side?
Beg your pardon?
Boxcars.
I think they had, yeah. It looked like a house by the time they got through with it. But fortunately it was well insulated, so
it
managed to
winter
pretty well. Yeah.
Wood stove?
Uh-huh.
No electricity?
Well, there's electricity.
Uh-huh. Excuse me, but that microphone's going to pick up that tapping, so we better not do that.
But wood was plentiful, and
sure.
All it cost was the labor to go out and get it, cut it, and bring it home.
Deb hadn't been used to cooking on a wood stove.
No, but she did pretty well.
You hadn't been used to chopping wood.
I guess that's right, yeah.
Did you learn?
Sure
did.
You learned a lot of things.
Had to chop your own? You had to chop your own wood?
Yep. And I learned pretty quickly what wood to burn and what not to burn.
Uh-huh.
So it was all very interesting and very exciting for a couple of young kids.
I'm sure it was. What were you paid?
$360 a month, we started.
Did that include your housing?
Yeah, I think we paid no rent. I forgot a little bit now. I remember I was shocked at the first winter month we had. The house was heated with fuel oil. Mm. Half my paycheck went to buy fuel oil in the first month. Mm. $360 a month wasn't bad in those days. You know, it, it was in 1949.
That was a lot.
Yeah.
Did you have a car?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Had a car. Had a Ford. Ford sedan. You know, one of those teardrop looking things that Ford made. One of the early V8s.
Hmm.
I think it was a pre-war vintage.
Yeah. And Bev taught school.
Yep, she taught school.
Right there. She didn't have far to go.
No, the schoolhouse was not far from where we lived.
Mm-hmm.
You know, within walking distance. And she taught second or third grades.
Mm-hmm. Small classes, I suppose.
Yeah, we should ask her about that, mm-hmm. but I would think that she might have had 20 kids in the two mm-hmm. classes, I suppose.
Did you come home for lunch?
No, we had gotten some of these things. Now they served lunch at the mess hall in the boarding house. And I think for the most part I had lunch there. I think they served lunch for a nominal something like 50 cents or 25 cents a day. Because they had a boarding house near the mill. Was a single man state. And, I started work as a surveyor in the mine. There was a good deal of construction work going on. They were moving a crushing plant at the time. So that first summer I did the surveying for the crushing plant, and then did the work to keep the mine maps up to date.
What sort of equipment were you using for surveying?
Well, transit and level, I suppose. Standard stuff for those days, and nothing mm-hmm. modern like the surveyors use today.
Plane table?
No, I don't think I did any. Well, I may have done some plane table work laying out haul roads,
mm-hmm.
but most of it was transit work.
Okay. What did you wear? What kind of clothes did you wear?
Well, that's an interesting question.
This was before t-shirts and blue jeans, I think.
No, it wasn't before blue jeans.
Well,
no, I think I wore Levi's. And
did you, or khakis?
I wore khakis, and I think I wore Levi's in when I was working in the mine.
Did you?
And, cotton work shirts. And when I went to work in a smelter, I wore khakis. The cheapest I could buy. I think we bought them at Sears because it burned them off of me so often.
Khaki shirts as well as
shirts
pants?
Shirts and pants, yeah.
Uh-huh. Safety shoes, safety hats?
Yeah. Used high top, boots with steel caps in the toes.
Were they provided for you, or did you have to pay for them?
I could have bought them.
Mm-hmm. Hard hats?
Yeah, I wore hard hats to mine.
What were they made of?
I think fiberglass, but I'm not sure. I suppose quite similar to the hard hats we wear today.
They weren't as pretty. They didn't come in decorator colors in those days, did they?
Oh, no, they sure didn't. You know that.
Sort of dark brown, weren't they?
I suppose.
Yeah. Safety glasses?
Yeah, I wore safety glasses. Of course, I think almost all the glass lenses, the lenses that we wear today are what they used to call safety glasses, are plastic and don't shatter.
Yeah. Were you given safety training?
Yes, I had, I don't think the mine, well, yeah, they did, but I'd had mine rescue class when I was going to UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that I may have taught a class in mine safety at Stibnot. I'm a little bit foggy on that.
Mm-hmm. What sort of company was it? What about the Bradleys? Did you have any contact with them?
Quite a bit. The company was owned by the Bradley family. Mm-hmm. And
had you known them?
Jack Bradley was the family member who operated, managed the mining activities of the family. So he was...
Where did he live?
He lived in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Had you known him?
No, I didn't know him.
Did he come up to the mine?
He came quite often, yeah. And yeah, he was there. You see, shortly after I arrived, they began construction of a smelter,
mm-hmm.
which was a significant investment for them. And a departure from mine, and up to that point had been selling concentrate to a smelter in Southern California. So I think Jack Bradley was there during the summertime, often watching progress of construction.
Were you still there when the automobile accident happened?
I think I left. I'm not sure. Do you remember the year?
No.
No, I don't either.
It was...
No, I think, no, I'm sure that by that time I was working for Utah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I was thinking it was about 1950 when they...
That's right. 50? You think so?
But maybe later.
Well, I don't know.
Maybe later.
But it occurred after I left.
I see.
Didn't
I? So I was...
I left there in 51.
Thinking so. What the effect of that would have been on the company.
Yeah.
On the mine.
Well, by that time... See, the mine was winding down and closed in 52, I think, just a year after I left it. So
did they recoup their investment on the smelter?
I don't know. I doubt it.
Oh.
I doubt it. That smelter ran for three years, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. So you went there in 48?
I went there in
48. Uh-huh. And they built it?
Left it. I believe it began to operate in been the summer of 49? I think probably so.
Mm-hmm.
And 50, 51, it shut down in 52. So market conditions have shut it down. There's still quite a bit of ore left in the pit.
Hmm.
Want to talk about the smelter in a minute, but before we get to that, you mentioned flying up there with your friend Griswold, but then you also were a pilot, weren't you?
Well, I learned to fly.
When did you
after, get off? You know, at Stibnite.
I see, that's where.
Or at Boise.
Mm.
You know, in those days, the veterans of World War II were granted some money for education.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some left over when I graduated, so I applied that to take a flying license.
I see.
And I soloed in Boise.
See, how far away was Boise?
Well, it was, I think we just ride out 100 miles by road. No, it was 100 miles by air, so. I think it was almost about a 3.5-4 hour drive. Hmm.
So you would drive down there on your day off, or?
Well, we didn't get many days off. In the summertime, we worked 12 days and then had 2 days off.
8 hour days?
Yeah.
Hmm.
The theory was you couldn't go any place in one day.
No.
So you might as well put 2 weeks back to back and have 2 days to go no place.
So in the winter, this changed.
I think we worked. Oh boy, I'm really foggy on this.
Most people worked a 6 day week still.
Well, that was all a 6 day week.
Uh-huh.
Now, and I. Whether we switched to a 6 day week or did that 12 on and 2 off, I don't really don't remember.
No. So how did you manage the flying lessons?
I didn't fly a heck of a lot. After I left, I moved to California. Little kids were coming along. I really couldn't afford to fly. Couldn't afford to rent an airplane.
But you did get your license.
Yeah,
up there.
I did.
Uh-huh.
Let it lapse then after it moved.
I see. Did you ever have your own plane?
No.
No.
Then years later, I did it all over again here.
Oh, did you?
In California, yeah.
Uh-huh. Hmm.
Right, where were we?
Let's talk about the smelter. You were smelter foreman and then smelter superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
And you were going to talk about some of the health problems at the smelter.
The industrial health hazards and smelters were not generally recognized in those days. Of course, they knew that the fellows working around mercury would get heavy metal poisoning, and those in the lead smelters, but it really wasn't, I think, understood how all this came about. And the smelter in Stibnite, with the high arsenic content of the ore, there was just an awful lot of arsenic oxides floating around in the atmosphere. And go ahead.
I was going to say just a little bit about the mechanics of the smelter. You had a crusher and then ore going in.
Well, the smelter was on the tail end of the concentrator. First, you have a concentrator where the ore crushed at the pit, hauled by a truck some 2 miles to the mill concentrator, ground, and then treated by flotation to separate the end product with two concentrates, an arsenopyrite concentrate and an antimony concentrate. Those concentrates were then stockpiled, allowed to dry. Then conveyed from the stockpile to the roaster building.
Were there hazards in the mill?
No, not the mill. Not industrial health problems.
Right.
But once you got these the arsenic sulfides and the antimony sulfides in the roaster, then you began the oxidation process, and as a result of that, you had arsenic oxide, antimony oxide, filling the roaster building.
They were roasted
like a fog.
They were roasted separately.
Yeah, and they were roasted separately.
Two separate circuits. You don't call it a circuit.
Yes, we had two large Hirschhoff roasters.
Hirschhoff?
Yeah.
How do you spell that?
H-E-R-S-C-H-O-F-F.
Okay.
I believe.
All right. And you were driving off the gases?
No, your the mineral arsenopyrite is an iron arsenic sulfide, and stibnite is an antimony sulfide. The roasting process is to oxidize the sulfide in order to provide a feed for the reduction furnace. The off gases from the roasters were ducted to a baghouse where they arsenic and antimony oxides were collected. And those oxides then made up part of the charge that went into the electric furnace.
But there was leakage or escaping throughout the system.
Well, the baghouse, the worst part of the roaster building and the baghouse was, the worst part of it. But the smelter building itself had let me back up a little bit. I'll go back through the process. The calcine concentrate from the roaster was combined with the oxides collected in the baghouse and charged in the electric furnace. there was a great deal of metal oxide leakage out of the electric furnace, and then that's when the antimony, when the metal was tapped from the furnace, it contained from 3 to extreme incidences, extreme conditions, almost 20% arsenic. And that arsenic was oxidized from the antimony in small reverberatory furnaces using compressed air. So the arsenic was once again oxidized, and although we had dust collection equipment, still there was just an awful lot of that stuff floating.
Mm. Did people wear masks?
I think those, the operators who were operating the the reverberatory furnaces wore some sort of breathing apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that they were generally used as smelter.
Hmm.
Of course, that then led to a good deal of problems arising out of the heavy metal poisoning. But the first thing that went was a little division called a septum, the division between the nostrils.
Mm-hmm.
And in extreme cases, the body absorbed the arsenic and antimony that affected the kidneys, and that's where I got in trouble.
Mm.
I think it was probably in 1950 that I began to report into the doctor. Well, by this time, the doctor was checking everyone who worked in the smelter weekly. He would take samples of hair and fingernails, as well as blood samples, ship them off to be analyzed, and to keep track of the, you know, the health of of the workforce. He called me in one day and he said, "You've got a problem. Your kidneys, I think I had probably gone to it feeling terrible. And kidneys were about to fail."
Ooh.
And he said that he would treat that condition with a drug called BAL, which is British anti-lewisite. He said it's been used 4 times in the United States.
Hmm.
As yet, no one has survived.
Oh my.
I said, "Well, what's the alternative?" He said, "You're not going to last long."
And you were not particularly aware of this until?
No.
Insidious, isn't it?
Yeah.
Huh.
So he said, and I said, "We've not used this before, and I don't know what's going to happen." And Bev was teaching school, and she said, "Shall I call Bev?" I said, "No, let's go."
Hmm.
So he gave me a shot on the buttock. And it was the most excruciating pain I ever felt.
Mm.
And, I remember lying on this hospital bed in my stomach. And he had cinched me down the bed with so sort of a canvas vest. And he tied my hands to the to the railings on his bed. He tied my feet to the... I was really cinched down. He gave me the shot. My goodness, it hurt. And I twisted the iron pipes in the bedsteads. I just pulled them off. I got a shot of this stuff every 30 minutes. And the reaction was an exothermic reaction. The drug interacted with the metal in the muscle cells and created heat. And as this, as the drug began to solubilize the metal in the cells, and this heat progressed from my rear end down in my feet and up the top of my head. And oh boy.
Heating you up all over your body.
And, see, to me, the first 2 hours, the first 4 shots were just terrible. And then the pain began to diminish. And, and I guess it was that my kidneys began to work. I began passing the heavy metal off in the urine.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was quite an experience.
Was this a company doctor?
Yeah,
company hospital and so on?
Company doctor, company hospital.
And you were the only...
Well, we were sure fortunate that he was, you know, he recognized the potential for problems there and was ready to treat it.
Were you the only person that had this problem?
No, subsequently then there were... I think three others that had a problem similar to mine. But by that time then, he had, I think everybody's wearing respirators and trying to take care of themselves and his mother. So I was the fifth one in the United States to be shot with BAL, the first one to survive. The others have been in mercury operations. And I expect they were too far gone to respond.
Sure.
But it left no ill effects.
Really? Well, that's the kind of distinction you could well do without. But what an experience, my. And you continued to work there then?
I'm trying to think of the doctor's name. I guess it was Mortensen.
Mortensen?
Mortensen, who left and practiced in Salt Lake City.
S-E-N, I suppose.
O-R-T.
E-N-S-E-N?
S-E-N.
Probably. Well, that's quite a story.
So, let's see, I didn't, while all this was going on, I was recuperating. I did not go back in a smelter. I did something else. I think I worked in the laboratory. And subsequently then went back to the smelter.
You did? It took some courage.
I don't know. I was too dumb to understand what was going on, I think.
You make good friends in a place like that?
Oh, sure do. We made friends then who are today our best friends.
People that you worked with up there?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Clarkson was chief engineer when I went to work at the mine. And he and his family live in Reno today.
Mm-hmm.
Bev and Edna Clarkson talk over the telephone every other day or so.
Really?
Bob started a company called the Clarkson Company.
Nice.
Manufacturer of slurry valves.
Mm-hmm. It's well known, very successful.
And
he's a lot older than you are, though, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Bob is 87.
Yeah.
87. Still a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Ed DeMoss and his wife Annabelle were Stib Knight. They worked for Utah and retired some time ago, live in Idaho. Keith Wallace, Alice. Worked for Utah. And
you brought them along with you to Utah?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll get into that
right.
History of how we got to Utah.
Well, maybe it's, is it time to go to Molly Corp then?
All right.
How did that come about?
Well, as the mine was winding down, Harold Bailey took a position with, Harold Bailey was the manager of the Yellow Pine Mine.
Mm-hmm.
And he was hired by Molybdenum Corporation of America to manage the Mountain Pass mine. This was a deposit of bastnasite.
What?
Bastnesite. Which is a rare earth. Rare earth oxide, I guess. And Molly Corp was controlled by a man named Marx Hirsch. M-A-R-X Hirsch. H-E-R-S-S-C-H, I guess.
Probably.
Who owned Ronson Company, you know, the lighter manufacturer.
I tried to find out something about Molly Corp, and I was surprised to find how little information there is.
Yeah, Molly Corp disappeared, see. Molly Corp owned
very little in
a molybdenum mine in New Mexico called the Cuesta mine.
Mm-hmm.
And Union Oil Company bought Molly Corp in order to, I think their main interest was that Cuesta mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think must have bought them in the 60s.
Right.
So Molly Corp went out of existence quite a while ago.
Although they still use the name.
I think they do.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But there was and they were also connected somehow with Pato?
With what?
Pato in Colombia?
Maybe. Perhaps so. Oh, I'm not well, I can't help you on that one.
No, but not at the time that
no.
Uh-huh, okay. But molybdenum was just the hottest thing around for a few years
it was.
There.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. But you were not mining molybdenum.
No, we were not mining molybdenum. We were mining
the rare earth.
Rare earth oxide.
Uh-huh.
And
for Grace?
That was the time when, you know, television sets were just being developed, and the one of the rare earth metals, lanthanum, was being used in as the color phosphor in the television tubes.
Hmm.
That was a principle of desirable, you know, principal economic metal of that rare earth group.
You're picking up that noise. I'm sorry. Maybe if I move this a little bit.
Oh, that's all right.
I'll move this up a little bit. Okay. Yeah, those TV tubes were have gone out completely now, of course.
I was in 51 when I started working. Fall of 51,
and this
I was mill superintendent.
And this was where? Where is
in,
Mountain Pass?
Near Nipton, California. It's on the highway between Barstow and Las Vegas. Near the Nevada border.
Quite a change from Stibnite.
Yeah, I should say.
Mm.
I'll find a map around here.
Okay.
Show it to you.
What did that involve?
Well,
open pit mine.
It was a small open pit mine, you know, standard crushing. We separated the rare earth minerals by a flotation process, which really didn't work very well. And for the first, well, I guess almost the first year, it was touch and go whether the mine would continue operating, and we developed the process that flotation process that worked quite efficiently and saved the mine's bacon, and the operation is still functioning.
It is. You went in as mill superintendent?
Yeah, I did.
To solve the problems?
Well, to start up the mill. They thought they had the problems solved.
Oh,
but when
up.
We started the mill and we tried to produce an acceptable concentrate, you know, it was very difficult.
It had
not been
operating before?
No, it had not.
I see. A brand new operation.
There was a metallurgist who worked for Denver Equipment Company, the principal manufacturer of flotation cells in those days, named Jim Lange, L-A-N-G-E. You may have met him. No?
I've heard the name.
Jim Lange.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jim worked with me and a metallurgist named Herb Blank. We'll have to, Bev will remember his name.
Okay.
We developed a process that required heating the feed to the flotation cells to just about the boiling point. And once that was done, then an acceptable concentrate was made.
And this was developed after the mill was
built? Yeah, after the mill was Dr. Mill was built and operated.
And you weren't hired for the design or the... Were you in on the planning of the mill?
Yes, I was in it. I was there on the construction of the mill.
I see.
But not the process development.
Uh-huh.
Process development had been done by some laboratory in the East.
I see.
Really didn't know what they were doing. But we had a lot of fun out there. We lived in a trailer house.
With
three children.
Well, it cements a relationship, doesn't it?
Boy, it's either that or tears it apart.
Uh-huh, right. Hot?
Well, at first, when I first started work there, Bev lived in San Bernardino.
Mm.
And I'd spend, we were back to the old 12-2 system. I'd spend 12 days to mine and then spend a two-day weekend in San Bernardino.
Mm-hmm.
Subsequently then we mined, Molly Corp bought some trailer houses, moved into a trailer house. Had a little bitty shower in a trailer house, and I dropped the soap on the floor. I had to get clear out of the shower to pick it up. That was a real experience.
What was your water supply?
We developed water up at the head of a canyon about 3 miles from the mine.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to develop enough water to operate the mill.
Mm-hmm.
And provide potable water for the camp.
How big a camp was it?
You know, I really don't. Total employees may have been 50 or 60.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a small operation.
Mm-hmm.
And many of those would have been either local or single men. I think probably there were not many, maybe 8 to 10 families living there.
What did you do for social life?
Went to Las Vegas to the,
oh.
Saw some great shows. Uh-huh. We were only, we were 60 miles from Las Vegas.
I see. Uh-huh.
So some entertainer of note was in Las Vegas. We could get in and out without any problem.
Uh-huh. You could get babysitters?
And we had friends there who took care of the children when we go to town. And later we moved to a town, a ghost town called Good Springs.
Good Springs?
Good Springs, Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
Ghost town. This had been a mining town. There have been in the past some zinc operations there. And the town had been probably 100 houses or more. And then when we got there, I think there were 4. Families living in that town. So,
but there were houses.
There were houses, yeah.
Uh-huh.
We lived in a house. We were very glad to get out of that trailer house.
Uh-huh.
That was terrible.
How old were your children then?
Well, by that one, that time, I suppose, let's see. Better turn the recorder off. I'm trying to think about
you
that.
Went with molybdenum in 1951.
Yeah.
To 54.
So we had.
You were there 3 years.
When we moved in, we had two children. Our youngest was born in Pasadena. No, actually, gets born in Tulare, but we were living in Pasadena at that time. So ages range from like she may have been a year old by the time we moved to five.
So yeah. School was not an item.
School was not a problem at that point.
You had health care in Las Vegas?
Beg your pardon?
Health care, where did you go for that?
Las Vegas.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Why Pasadena? You hadn't mentioned that before.
I think we were there because the manager, Harold Bailey, lived in Pasadena.
Oh, I see.
And one other employee had settled his family in Pasadena.
That was quite a ways away.
Yeah, it was.
Uh-huh.
I said Pasadena, no, I mean San Bernardino.
San Bernardino.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes a little more sense. All right, San Bernardino.
Yeah.
Okay. So you were there first and then got all together.
Yeah,
all
then moved into Trotter House, then moved to Good Springs.
Okay. Wood stove? No. Not
Good
in
Springs? No, I don't
no
think
no trees.
So. Probably
butane, maybe.
I bet it was propane.
Propane.
Yeah.
Okay. So you got the mill operating acceptably.
Yeah, we finally got it running, and sometime in early 1954, was it? A visit by an old friend from Stibnite days, Tony Macia, came by to say hello and mentioned kind of an afterthought that he had gone to work for Utah Construction Company.
This is MECIA?
MECIA.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was he doing out there visiting you?
Well, he came to see if he could encourage me to move to San Francisco.
I see.
So he left that time here in Los Altos.
And he had been up at Stibnite.
Yeah, he'd been manager of the Ima mine, which was a scheelite, underground scheelite operation in the Cimarroy Valley in eastern Idaho. And then I guess he had come to Stibnite when they shut the Ima mine down. He and Betty and their children lived in Stibnite, and he was assistant mine manager at that point.
At the Yellow Pine?
Yeah, the Yellow Pine mine.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, must have been in in the spring of 1954. Tony came to visit and said they needed someone in San Francisco, and I came overnighted with them here in Los Altos and went to San Francisco. I was interviewed by Alan Christensen, who was then president of Utah, who was then the Utah Construction Company.
So that's A-L-L-E-N?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Their offices were in a different place at that time.
The office was on, was in the Crocker Building on Market Street. Mm-hmm. So apparently Alan liked what he heard because he offered me a job and I accepted. And went to work for Utah in, it's been June 1954.
What did you know about Utah?
Well, I knew quite a bit about it from its construction history. One of the Utah had figured in all of the big reclamation projects in the West as I was growing up. Boulder Dam, Grand Coulee Dam, Hoover Dam. Well, I was impressed and really happy to have an opportunity work for that company.
They were just beginning to branch out into mining.
They had an iron ore mine in Vancouver Island. And an iron ore mine in Cedar City, Utah. And there at Cedar City they operated a mine owned by Colorado Fuel and Iron Corporation.
So, what were you hired to do?
Well, I was a metallurgist, and I was hired to see what was wrong with the iron ore mine in, on Vancouver Island, BC.
That was
Utah had operated these mines with construction folks, and had, I think when Tony joined them, they had one man on the payroll who had experience in mining. About the time they hired Tony Mesilla, they employed Weston Bray, who was a geologist, an exploration geologist. And they were having trouble with the plant in on Vancouver Island producing iron ore of sufficient grade to meet the specifications.
Texada mine?
No, Texada was owned by Alan Christensen himself.
Oh.
This was the Argonaut mine.
Argonaut.
Campbell River. So that choice, turned out to be a very simple one. The problem was that they were using magnetic pulleys on belts to separate magnetite from waste rock. And and the ore was simply not, hadn't been crushed fine enough to liberate the magnetite from the waste rock. So it meant putting in wet magnetic separators, crushing the ore down to about 1/4 inch, and it worked fine.
This is something new for you to get into, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, but it was kind of up my alley with the metallurgical education and background that I had.
So you went up to Vancouver to work on this, did you?
I did. The other day I was hired, I was on an airplane going to Campbell River. And for some reason or another, no one had told me to check in with the personnel office, so they didn't know where I was and didn't know where to send a paycheck.
Was your family still down in Good Springs? Or?
No, we had moved here and we lived in Mill Valley. We rented a house in Mill Valley.
I see.
Happy to get to the city.
I'm sure. So you were commuting. How did you commute from Mill Valley in those days?
By bus. Took me. I finally bought a second automobile when. No, I guess we decided to move from Mill Valley. When it was taking me longer to get from the airport to my home by public transportation than it did by aircraft from Vancouver to San Francisco. So I guess it was in 1956, and we moved to Palo Alto.
To be near the airport.
To be near the airport. That was
You were spending much of your time away then?
Well, we started, I mentioned this Argonaut mine.
Yeah.
And shortly thereafter, Utah bought an interest in the Lucky Mac Uranium Corporation.
This was the heyday of uranium, wasn't it?
Yep, sure was.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a contract with the Lucky Mac Uranium Corporation too. Develop I have to be careful about this now, just get everything in the proper order. I think Utah contracted with Lucky Mac to operate the mine and build the plant, the concentrator. And design the process. And subsequently then bought an interest, bought